or partying. It was more just sitting around, eating food, and talking about our previous travel and some of our views on life. Aaron would still remain pretty quiet during the latter conversations. Mark taught him how to make little bracelets out of string, as the monks had taught him in one of the monasteries during his free time there. Later I had Aaron teach it to me as well. It was a relaxing way to pass the time when I wasn't working on trying to make money. One such money-making endeavor turned out to be perfectly timed. I got a little creative after a while and shifted from strictly graphic design work to doing just about anything I could to get a paycheck. Well, besides like a butthole reenactment of the ping pong show. A friend who, for the sake of her college degree, will remain nameless, asked me if I could write an essay for her college class. I figured I'd give it a shot. I actually like stuff like that, and if the American college loan system wasn't a gigantic succubus of debt, I would have loved to have gone myself. I told her I'd do it, and then asked what the essay was about. She said it was about Buddhism. I chuckled and looked to my right, where Mark, a man who had just spent 6 months comprehensively living and learning Buddhism in real traditional monasteries, was sitting and watching a movie on his cell phone. I waved my hand to get his attention, and he removed his headphones. "What's up? Can you tell me enough about Buddhism, like the history of it and stuff, to write a paper for someone?" "My friend, I can tell you enough about Buddhism to write a book. Would you like me to start from the beginning?" And thus, my first college essay received an A, even though I've never paid for nor attended a university of any kind. I ended up doing a few more on different subjects before returning home. We had planned to travel together, Mark, Aaron, and I, to some islands a little southwest of Penang before Mark left to return to Thailand. That never happened. We loved the little guest house so much and the friends we had made there that every time we came up with a date to leave, it got scrubbed. "I'm thinking maybe we should just stay another couple nights here. What do you guys think?" Mark would suggest. "That's cool with me." Then, a few days later, the same conversation would occur once more. The owner and the girl working there both became close friends of ours during our stay. We'd get free fruit, free beers, and even got discounted laundry during our stay there. They were both of Philippine Islander descent, and it stood to testament that those islands must be a paradise of good-natured and kind people. We had another experience with Filipino people when Wilson, our drug-peddling host in Switzerland, had dropped us off at Lake Beale. After he left, a Filipino family saw us sitting on the rocks and sharing one can of tuna. They were having a cookout on the lake shore and brought us over heaped plates of rice, barbecued chicken, and vegetables. We'd tried to pay them afterwards, and they just waved their hand at us and laughed. These two running the guest house were no exception. They were cheerful in demeanor and joked around with each other as well as the guests almost constantly. The owner, quote, fired the girl probably 10 times every day. She'd laugh and throw something at him, and they would shout at each other wildly for a few seconds, and then they'd laugh together. The great cheeseburger blunder was avenged by the discovery of another obsession, Milo. For those of you poor, poor souls who've never had a taste of Milo, let me fill you in. Milo is made by Nestle. In fact, it's almost identical to Nesquik, except for one significant difference. The crunchies. Imagine Nesquik with little crunchy bits of chocolate in it. The Malays made it with warm milk and served it over ice. A hot Milo is what you would order. It was Tom who introduced me to this powdered miracle substance. "You're telling me you've never fucking heard of Milo, mate?" He called over the short little manager girl, and she promptly brought me a glass of the mystery liquid. My eyes widened upon the first taste. It was gone in approximately 2 or 3 seconds. And they only cost $1. He went on to tell me that they made Milo cereal, candy bars, ice cream, milkshakes, just about anything else I could imagine. Later that evening, I made a trip to the store and tried one of just about all of them. The ice cream, the fucking Milo ice cream. Amazing. Aaron didn't catch on to the Milo craze that Tom and I were on. He and Mark both had a food obsession of their own, Indian cuisine. I tried multiple times with them at multiple different restaurants and tons of different dishes there, but I couldn't ever get into it. I don't think I found a single dish that I actually liked. I finished my plate each time, but I'd be lying if I said that I enjoyed it. Aaron could eat the hottest shit on the fucking planet, and it wouldn't bother the guy one bit. You could fill a bowl with fresh lava, top it off with some of Satan's pubes, and then a dragon could come by and fart on it, and he would scarf the thing down. He'd be as red as a fire hydrant and sweating his ass off, but he'd finish it. Then he'd say something like, "It really wasn't as bad as they said it was going to be." It wasn't really the spiciness that repelled me from Indian food, but the mustiness. It just tasted and smelled musty. Sometimes bland, sometimes spicy, but almost always musty. That's the only word I can think of to describe it. And it never failed that anywhere we walked to, the local mall, exploring the fishing village nearby, anywhere, Aaron and Mark would want to eat in an Indian restaurant. After a while, I just learned to wander off and find a Thai or a Chinese restaurant to eat out alone. I never did see a single place that offered Malay food. In fact, I still have no idea what Malay food even is, or if it's even a thing. Many times I just ate at the guest house restaurant. I spent every morning sitting at a table overlooking the street, sipping on a coffee or an iced Milo, and eating a ham and cheese omelet, the most American thing I'd had in months. That place could make a hell of an omelet. Outside, in the morning hustle and bustle, Malay and Indian locals would rush about on bicycles, small cars, and big lumbering buses. To enter the shops and restaurants, people would walk on wooden planks over the canals of feces. Oh wait, did I forget to mention that? Yeah, in lieu of traditional cement sidewalks, the Malaysian, or more likely British, builders of yesteryear felt it more convenient to put 2 or 3 foot ditches along the roads. Then they thought, "Hey, those ditches look okay, but what should we fill them with?" "Rainwater," somebody offered. "Hey, every city's got rainwater. What they don't have is a lazy river of shit, piss, and dead animal carcasses." Everyone collectively gasped, clapped, and gathered outside to begin shitting in the ditches. In reality, I'm not sure what those canals of slime were really filled with. All I know is they were brown, stinky, and I saw more than one bloated animal carcass floating in them, along with scores of wrappers and beer bottles. The astonishing thing was that they were just right there with nothing over them. You'd think they'd put a grate on them or something. No, they were just wide open ditches where some unsuspecting person could slip and fall right into the cholera factory below. All the shops had little wooden boards laid over the ditch upon which you could walk. This, no doubt, is what led to the mosquito hordes that frequented anywhere near the poop chutes of death. Luckily, our new guest house was far enough away from the street that we didn't seem to have any mosquitoes bugging us. After 10 days in Penang, we finally made plans to leave. Mark was headed north to Koh Phangan, where we had been a couple weeks earlier, and Aaron and I were headed to Kuala Lumpur for a few days before catching our flight to Australia. We spent our last night in the guest house drinking beer. Jenny and Tom had left the previous night, but the owner of the guest house joined in on our little party and supplied us with a few free drinks, some watermelon, and plenty of Durham cigarettes. It was a bittersweet little gathering. I was sad to be parting ways with Mark. I had really grown to feel like he'd been one of my best friends for years. I wished Corey had stuck around long enough to meet him, because they would have loved each other. Aaron and I had been getting along better, but I had really enjoyed the sense of humor that Mark brought to the group, since that was a department Aaron tended to lack in. We tried our best to convince Mark to come with us to Australia, but he said he'd never have enough money to make it. I laughed at that, because neither did Aaron and I. Even with free places to stay, we'd be cutting it a little too close for comfort. The next morning I had my usual ham and cheese omelet and an iced Milo, smoked 3 cigarettes in a row while we waited for our bus, and slipped my rain cover on my pack when a typical Malaysian downpour started soaking us. When the bus finally pulled up, we said our last goodbyes to Mark and hopped on board. As happens all too often in travel, we said farewell to new friends having only just met them, and set forth on our next adventure. It's a strange feeling going to a new place, On one hand, you're somewhat reluctant to give up the comfort that you've had where you're at. On the other hand, you never know what the next place will have to offer. That's the suspenseful mystery of being a traveler, I suppose. End of chapter 24. Chapter 25, Kuala Lumpur, Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Our battered suitcases were piled on the sidewalk again. We had longer ways to go. But no matter, the road is life. Jack Kerouac, On the Road. October 13th. It was a long, quiet bus ride from Penang to Kuala Lumpur. Upon our arrival there, we were ushered off the bus and into a central transportation depot of sorts. Our planning for getting a hostel in Kuala Lumpur had consisted of looking out the windows as we pulled into the area and searching for signs. Almost 4 months into the trip, and we still hadn't learned that we needed to plan ahead. Fortunately, a hostel ended up being located just across the highway. So we shouldered our packs and made our way to a staircase which led to a walking bridge that spanned the road. As we walked across the little bridge, I noticed what at first I thought was a dead guy. Upon getting closer, I realized that no, the guy was just really drunk, homeless, and passed out in the middle of the walkway and with his hand completely down his pants, cupping his genitals, no less. A group of three police officers stood about 4 feet away from the sleeping vagrant, casually chatting. I wondered why in the hell they were letting the guy just sleep in the middle of the walkway like that, instead of asking him at the very least to move to one side. A question that goes unanswered to this day. We arrived at the hostel we'd spotted from the bus. It was run by a bunch of Indian guys in typical Indian fashion, dirty, smelly, and swelteringly hot. We were shown to our room, a private one, which I'll admit was a plus, and asked to, quote, turn off the lights and air conditioning unit when we left the room. I still have no idea where this air conditioning unit was that he was talking about. The beds were covered in cigarette burns, and admittedly I added quite a few more to their collection before leaving. You could hear the television blaring a foreign soap opera in the front room. Our little ceiling fan squeaked and rocked precariously back and forth. We set our packs down and each sat on our bed. Well, Aaron finally spoke up, at least the mosquitoes can't get us in here. I laughed. I'm glad one of us can find some optimism in this. A cockroach scurried across the floor between our feet. I lifted my feet onto the bed and lit up a cigarette. Malaysia is kind of a strange country. In its early days, Malaysia's inhabitants practiced Hinduism and Buddhism brought to them by way of India. The Malay Peninsula lay in the path of valuable shipping lanes, and subsequently to that end, it became quite the little empire in the 5th through the 7th centuries AD. Afterwards, up until around the 13th century, it lay under the domain of the Buddhist Sriwijaya Empire. All was peaceful and well in the archipelago during this period as trade and prosperity boomed. Just kidding, the Sriwijaya Empire totally killed the shit out of a bunch of people in other territories over the centuries, and many wars over trade goods and profits ensued. Isn't money fun? Around the 13th century, Islam began to take hold in the Malaysian archipelago, and peace really did ensue for a while. Well, sort of. This guy named Parameswara, who I'm just going to call Parmesan from now on because I have no fucking clue how to pronounce his real name, came to the peninsula after fleeing from persecution because of God knows what to Temasek, now known as Singapore. Old Parmesan, who claimed to be a descendant of Alexander the Great, I'm a little skeptical there, was taken momentarily under the protection of a Malay chief named Tamagi for a brief moment. Since Tamagi had been kind enough to take him in, Parmesan repaid the favor by killing his face off and taking over his position as chief. Legend has it that Tamagi's last words were, "Wow, seriously, dude?" His reign was short-lived and he was forced to flee Singapore after threats from the King of Siam, ruler and friend of the late Tamagi, made their way to him. From there, Parmesan went to the Malaysian Peninsula. According to the Malay annals, it was here that Parmesan saw a, quote, mouse deer outwitting a dog resting under a Malacca tree. which he saw as a good omen. So he decided to establish a kingdom there. Modern archaeologists are still trying to figure out exactly how much LSD this guy ingested on a daily basis. Mouse deer outwitting a what the fuck? My guess, based on my own experiences in the Malay Peninsula, is that Parmesan probably saw something more like a cockroach outwitting a dengue mosquito resting under an old rusty beer can in a feces pile. Anyway, this kingdom, known as Malacca, eventually became Malaysia, and all was perfectly simple and straightforward after that. Well, not really. There was a period of alliances with the Ming Dynasty in China, an escape from destruction by the Mongol Empire, and periods of wealth and power from trade during the following centuries. Eventually, the Dutch East Indies Company came about. We've already established that Malaysia was in a prime trading spot, so if you know anything about the history of the 17th century and the Dutch East Indies Company, then you know what's coming next. Some old white guys thought to themselves, hey, money! So they took it. Or at least until it became kind of inconvenient for them. In World War II, the Japanese did that whole invasion thing, and the situation got a little awkward. The British, who had promised all of their Southeast Asian subjects protection and escape if need be, promptly abandoned all notions of dignity and honor at the first sight of a Japanese zero. With a quick tip of a hat and a good luck, the British, who had lived in and subjugated the Malaysian Peninsula, as well as most of the Philippines, escaped back to Britain and left their island subjects to the hands of the Japanese. It wasn't until the last 30 years or so that Malaysia actually became Malaysia as we know it today. The result of hundreds of years of influence and rule by different religions, countries, and ideals has left the country a confusing potpourri of culture. For example, taxis are aptly called taxi, spelled T-A-K-S-I, which I'll assume blindly is simply how the locals heard the British word being pronounced. You'd find a modernized supermarket sitting right next to a fish shop whose workers threw guts and scrap meat into the poop ditches out front. Somehow no one had correlated the hordes of tenacious mosquitoes with stagnant water, so the poop ditches remained as a remnant of earlier years, and malaria and dengue fever were left to thrive in them. You could walk two blocks from a modern skyscraper or glass-encased bank building and arrive in a primitive fishing village on the outskirts of town where locals slept on planks and carved touristy trinkets out of coconut shells. It was as if the inhabitants couldn't figure out whether they wanted to catch up with modernized countries or remain in simplicity. For us, being budget travelers, simplicity was what we found. Aside from the wonderful guest house we'd stayed at with Mark in Penang, I found nothing but grime, slime, and sweat in the other places we stayed. Normally I'd have no qualm with these, considering we'd been ensconced in homeless living thus far, but at this point in our journey I was just so fucking tired. I wanted to go home, honestly. I had come to the conclusion that maybe long-term travel wasn't my cup of tea, at least not this kind of long-term travel. I missed home and its comforts, and I was tired of being dirty all the time. I hoped Australia would bring some familiarities of my former life. People will inevitably listen to this and say the negative things they will, but the listener should be reminded that at this point, money was such an issue that we weren't exactly going out and enjoying these places. The vast majority of my days was spent sitting in front of a computer trying to bring in more money. A final dab of salt in my wound was the daily torture that organized religion so deftly wrought on my ears without regard. Islam remained the country's main religion, which we were reminded of multiple times a day when mosques blasted prayer songs through loudspeakers across the entire city. I use the term songs very loosely because these guys were in serious need of auto-tune. It was a pitch-wild gibberish of tones that was blared into our ears all day. Then you would hear a cough into the microphone, then some handling noise as the singer readjusted the mic. All fucking day. Aaron, Mark, and I had devised plans to find these churches and tackle the singers right out of their chair. It was incessant. Want to take a nap? prayer song time. Want to Skype someone? Here comes the prayer song. Prayer song, prayer song, prayer song. Aaron and I only had a few days in Kuala Lumpur to prepare for our flight to Australia. One of the main tasks to accomplish was buying winter clothes. Yes, you heard me correct. I'll elaborate. At some point during our stay in Penang, it had dawned on me that maybe we should do some kind of research on New Zealand. It sounds ridiculous, even to me, that when we'd booked a 2-week stay there while planning our trip back at home, we had no idea what we were going to do during our stay. I didn't know shit about New Zealand. I just thought, hey, if I go to New Zealand, I'll be able to tell people I've been to New Zealand. I had assumed that we'd be sweating our balls off during our stay there and in Australia, just like everywhere else. Anyway, now I figured I'd see just what there was to do while we were there. So I messaged one of my graphic design clients who happened to live in Christchurch. She sent me the names of some cool places to check out, so I Googled them. The first image I saw was a huge turquoise-colored lake. Wow, I said to Aaron. You should see how cool this lake... Wait, is that fucking snow? Snow? Aaron asked. There's snow in this picture. That can't be right. New Zealand is, like, pretty far south, right? It was lost on me at the moment, rather ironically considering my obsession with polar exploration novels, that if you were to just keep on heading south, you'd end up in Antarctica. I'm going to look up the temperature there, Aaron offered. A few moments later. 45 degrees there right now. It's 45 fucking degrees. Oh my God. I'd given all the cold weather gear I had to Corey to take home when he'd left. I didn't want the extra weight. I mean everything. The pants I'd bought in Switzerland, my hooded sweatshirt, even my sleeping bag. Suddenly we found ourselves trying to find winter clothing in a country that had never even seen snow. You can probably guess how that went. The one factor that was on our side was that Kuala Lumpur was a metropolitan hub of shopping malls. We spent a day walking to one of the malls and looking for clothes. All I could find during this foray was a brand-name lightweight jacket, for which I paid about $60 U.S. Aaron opted to wait and find something cheaper. Part of missing home for me was missing simple things like dressing how I wanted, so I paid the extra money for a jacket I liked. I figured Aaron would make a fuss about it, but he didn't. He returned to the stinky hostel room empty-handed and resolved to head out the following day in search of his own clothes. When he left the next day, I decided to stay back at the hostel and get some computer work done. Aaron was gone most of the day, and after a while I started to wonder if he'd gotten lost given his well-known inhibitions with navigation. We had stayed in that same hostel for Bangkok the better part of 3 weeks, and he still, almost every single time, walked past the street it was located on, and then sometimes even debated with me when I told him he was about to pass it. It was fascinating, really. As darkness fell upon Kuala Lumpur that evening, my curiosity turned to worry and I started to seriously think something bad might have happened. Not enough to leave my computer and go looking or anything, mind you, but enough to casually ponder aloud, I wonder if Aaron ended up in Indonesia or something during this shopping trip. I didn't figure there was much I could do unless he still hadn't turned up by midnight or so. At that point, I probably would have had to contact local police and tell them to search for a white man in a Special Forces-style boonie hat spinning in circles with a map in his hand. Fortunately, my worry was for naught, and Aaron eventually came through the door to our room with arms full of shopping bags and a big grin on his face. Dude, look at all this stuff I got. Like, cold weather stuff, or... I spent the same amount of money you did on that one jacket, and I got 2 shirts, a hoodie... and a jacket. Nice. He promptly dug into the shopping bags and pulled out a sweatshirt. $10. Nice. Out next came 2 t-shirts. So far, I'm getting a little jealous, I'm not gonna lie. And check out this jacket. $30. He pulled out the most ridiculous garment I could imagine. I think it will do the listener best justice to have me read out the jacket he bought, described in bullet points. It was a denim jean jacket. It had Purple and pink inlays around the shoulders, much similar to a blanket woven by a Navajo tribeswoman. It was way too short. The bottom of the jacket came up to about his midriff. It was, in fact, as you may have surmised by now, a woman's jacket. I winced, and then continued as I had with the rest of the clothing. Nice. I didn't have the heart to tell him that he had bought a woman's jacket. For one, I could tell he was so proud that he'd gone shopping and found all this stuff for so much cheaper than I had paid for the jacket. I mean, he was practically waving the clothing in my face and going, "Nana, nana, boo-boo." Secondly, we were getting along so well that I didn't want to jeopardize our well-being as travel partners. So I did what I had been doing with all of our other social differences, quirks, etc. I laughed profusely on the inside while keeping a perfectly straight face on the outside. Or sometimes, in cases during which holding back the laughter was nearly impossible, as was the case with the woman's jean jacket's unveiling, smiling innocently, nodding my head in approval, and quickly returning to whatever I had immersed myself in. The rest of our time in Kuala Lumpur was spent eating, researching, and if we're going to be 100% honest here, laying around and watching movies on our computers, and smoking enough cigarettes to supply the cast of Mad Men for an entire season. I had contacted a couchsurfing host in Perth, Australia, who had agreed to put us up for a week. That situation had been a debacle all in its own. Elaboration. Australia, affectionately referred to as Oz by locals and travelers alike, had been somewhat ignored during our planning stage. This was solely due to the fact that we'd had a sure place to stay with room and board taken care of. Back in high school, we'd had a foreign exchange student named Ryan who came to our tiny little town all the way from the land down under. He made a lot of friends there, myself and Corey included. In fact, Corey and I had made plans years ago to go and visit him at his home in Perth, but they fell through when we realized that, A, we were too poor to afford plane tickets without saving up for quite a while, and B, we were too unmotivated to save up for quite a while. So the plans were scrapped. In the planning of our journey around the world, we knew Oz would be on our list of must-see countries, so we contacted Ryan, who gladly agreed to put us up for 3 months. Thus, since we knew we had a place to stay, not much planning went into this stage of the trip. We needed to divert our planning attention to places where it was desperately needed. You're now fully aware that even those attentions were pathetic and unfruitful. See, sleeping with homeless people or under bridges. Anyway, all was good in the land of Oz until a couple months prior when I received a casual message from Ryan that he had, quote, moved way out into the middle of the outback for a new job, and subsequently could no longer host us in Perth. This was bad news for us, considering that Oz was arguably the most expensive country on our list. He offered to put us up in his new place, but warned that there wouldn't be much to do and it would cost a couple $100 to board a train there from Perth, where our plane was set to land. We didn't have the money to make that happen, so we were bummed. I had really looked forward to seeing him, and it seemed crazy that here I was going to actually be in Oz and not even get a chance to grab a beer with my friend. Corey had been much closer with him than I was in high school, and Ryan was already disappointed that he'd went home instead of coming down to see him as well. There wasn't much that could be done, though, so our planning efforts went towards finding places to stay. Damo, the Aussie from In Out Hostel in Barcelona, offered to put us up in Melbourne and get me some shows booked if I could make it there. Again, travel fare was too costly to justify. Our departure flight was from Perth, so we would have to find a way back across the continent before leaving. I also sent messages to Bella and Naomi, two Aussie girls we had met at Hostel Happy Days in Rome, but neither was of much use for us either. So we were left with couch surfing. Luckily, we had pretty good luck in finding our first host, Anna. She not only accepted our request and offered to put us up for a week, but also offered to pick us up from the airport when we arrived. She told us there would be two other couch surfers staying there as well, a British couple. But since we had sent her a message first, we'd get a spare room all to ourselves. We didn't know what we'd do beyond that first week, but this was a great start. We had about a month in Oz before flying on to New Zealand. The original 3 months was scrapped when we'd changed all our flights a few weeks earlier. We figured we could just hop around between couch surfing hosts in Perth or find a place where we could camp for free, similar to what we'd done in Rome at the nature preserve. With our housing taken care of momentarily, we enjoyed our last couple days in Asia by gorging ourselves on delicious food. We knew we'd soon be back to a diet of tuna, rice, and peanut butter. Luckily for me, Kuala Lumpur offered a wider variety of food choices than Penang, and I took full advantage of it. I didn't have to eat Indian food and instead had my fill of every Asian dish I could get my hands on. Getting to the places without being killed was the tricky part. One thing I've neglected to mention about Southeast Asia, which played an immense part in our daily lives, or continuance thereof, was the dodging of traffic every day in order to go anywhere. It was insane. There were no crosswalks, at least as far as I could tell. Huge buses catapulted down the streets in a destructive manner, ignorant of any pedestrians who may be so unfortunate to find themselves on the road at the wrong time. Taxis and other cars and small trucks filled spaces between the big buses, and an infinite number of scooters, tuk-tuks, and motorcycles did a slalom through the whole busy parade. Crossing the street was done like so. 1. Approach street. Look both ways. 2. Wait for a small gap in between the vehicles speeding past in the lane directly in front of you. 3. Pray to whatever deity you call God. 4. Sprint forward through the gap and stop in the middle of the street between the lanes to avoid being hit by traffic in the next lane. Traffic is rushing past you from 1 to 2 feet away on both sides now. 5. Repeat steps 2 to 4. 6. Once you've reached the middle lane, pause and catch your breath / make sure your asshole hasn't imploded from excessive puckering. 7. Repeat steps 2 to 4. You're close to being across now. A bus whizzes past, a foot away from your face. 8. You pee your pants just a little. 9. Run! Last lane. And 10. Try not to remind yourself that you'll have to repeat this process 2 to 10 times to get wherever you're going. Somehow we made it through our 2-month stay in Asia without becoming gruesome hood ornaments, although there were countless close calls. With the purchase of whatever cold weather garments we could find, not a sufficient amount, a place to stay in Perth secured, and just enough money to make it home without starving to death, our adventure in Thailand and Malaysia finally came to a close. I had one last rinse in the slime pit of a shower in our hostel and looked through a window in the stall at the rooftop between buildings directly outside, which was covered in decaying food waste, dead rats, and other trash. The flap that was supposed to cover the window opening was torn and visibly moldy, hanging on by a couple threads and a prayer. The water was, of course, ice cold, and I felt decidedly more dirty and maybe more likely to test positive for hepatitis afterwards. I went back to my bed, smoked a cigarette, and then rolled back and forth for 5 hours until my alarm went off at 5 a.m., approximately 20 minutes after I'd finally fallen asleep. I cursed everything that had caused me to be awake at that hour and lit up another cigarette as I threw my things into my pack to leave. We took a taxi to the airport, which helpfully dropped us off at the wrong terminal. We were then stopped by police as we attempted to run across the busy airport streets to find another ride. From there, we were directed 4 floors down to a parking garage where taxis awaited riders. This one took us to the correct airport, where we shuffled through a maze of shuttles before finding our terminal. I smoked approximately 1 entire pack of cigarettes during this 2-hour ordeal. We were shown the path to our plane at the very last minute and ran through the rain across the tarmac. We boarded just as the stairs were about to be pulled away. I remember distinctly thinking as the plane taxied onto the runway, the same thing I had thought 2 months earlier around the time we were leaving Europe. Finally, some food other than... wait, we'll still be eating rice every day. End of chapter 25. Chapter 26, Land Down Under, Perth, Australia. Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, and many of our people need it sorely on these accounts. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime. Mark Twain. October 17th, day 117. It's fucking cold. Those were the first words out of my mouth when I stepped out of the airport in Perth. How is that possible? I thought Australia was warm all year round. In our seemingly endless ignorance, we neglected to look up the weather in Oz after we'd found out how cold New Zealand would be. Now, I know what you're thinking. I can see the look of astonishment on your face. You should have learned by now never to underestimate my boundless obliviousness. I slipped on my pathetic little jacket, which seemed to have the insulation rating of a paper grocery bag, and lit up a cigarette. Our couch surfing host, whom I contacted once I was able to connect to the airport's Wi-Fi, wasted no time in coming to pick us up. Anna was a short-haired woman with an athletic build. She wore Oakley sunglasses and spoke with, as you'd expect in Oz, the traditional Aussie accent, which is one of my favorite accents, actually. We threw our bags into the back of her little car and hopped in. She explained on the way to her house that we'd have a room all to ourselves and could pretty much do what we pleased during our stay there. She worked during the day, but we'd be given a key to the house to come and go as we desired. We could take a bus nearby and to downtown Perth. Her house was located in a suburb on the outskirts of the city. The only rule was that there was to be no smoking inside. Coincidentally, guess what Aaron and I planned to do when we arrived in Oz? You guessed it, quit smoking. In fact, we'd been so confident, even despite our pathetic failures and dismal attempts in the past, see smoking cigarette butts found on the ground, that we'd listed on our couch surfing requests that we were non-smokers. Neither of us really wanted to quit. Not even close, actually. But we'd heard rumors of cigarettes costing $20 US a pack in the land down under. These rumors turned out to be 100% true, by the way. So this time we felt we didn't have a choice. We entered Australia with little more than a handful of smokes and the drive to finally commit to quitting. Finally. No, seriously, we were serious this time. We were really quitting. I know you're already expecting us to fail, but I even wrote it in big letters in my journal this time so I would know how serious I was. That drive to quit didn't stop us from carefully rationing the last of our Marlboros, though. They became the equivalent of fresh water whilst lost at sea in a raft, just a drag here and there to tide us over from killing and ravenously eating each other. On that note, as could probably be expected, complications came about from our nicotine-deprived endeavor. We started to get on each other's nerves again. Well, to Aaron's credit, I think he handled it pretty well. Me, on the other hand, not so much. Every single thing that Aaron did slowly started to eat away at me. The fact that he went to sleep at like 9 p.m. and woke up at 8 a.m. for no reason whatsoever. The fact that because of this, he was always coming into the room early as shit in the evening and saying, "You care if I turn this light off, man?" And then a half hour later, quietly whispering in the darkness, "How much longer do you think you're going to be up?" As if I'd planned to go to sleep at exactly 9:37 p.m. or something. I don't know, man. Whenever I get tired, I guess. I didn't plan out what time I'd fall asleep tonight. I mean, it's not like we have anything to do tomorrow. "Is the light from my computer keeping you up or something?" I would ask condescendingly. He would always say, "Oh, I was just wondering," and then roll back over. Those little exchanges started to tear away at me. I snapped at him here and there, but for the most part kept up my feigned indifference towards his social tics and quirks. The second day in Perth, the two other couch surfers Anna had mentioned arrived. They were given a spot in the living room to spread out their sleeping bags. The nice thing to do would have been to offer them our room, but that wasn't happening. We were alternating nights of sleeping on the bed or the floor, and neither Aaron nor I were ready to give that up. Ashley and Sarah were a British couple who were planning to move semi-permanently to Oz. Ashley, or Ash, was a guy, which American listeners may find strange, unless you played Pokemon as a kid, in which case Ash seems like a perfectly viable name. I liked the two of them from the start. They had been a couple for something like 6 or 8 years, I think, which was plainly noticeable by their endless bantering. I say that in the best possible way because it was hilarious. It was playful rather than mean-spirited. Ash said the most ridiculous shit to that woman, and she just carried on like nothing. She'd drop something or forget something, and he'd say, "You're so fucking stupid. I don't even know why I let you keep being my girlfriend." And she would laugh, and then she'd give it right back to him, and he'd take it with equal humor. They were staying with Anna for a few days while they shopped around for a Jeep or other Outback-capable vehicle. They planned to drive it through the desert to a farm they were set to work at a few weeks hence. Anna was an awesome couch surfing host and took the four of us around to quite a few places. We checked out the beach, a park where we searched in vain for kangaroos, and she even cooked us dinner and bought us beers on quite a few occasions. The kangaroo thing was a big deal. All of the foreigners, Aaron, Ash, Sarah, and myself, were obsessed with seeing one. Anna had hoped we'd spot one in the nearby park, but alas, we were left rueless during our visit. We did, however, go to a children's festival in the park with Anna's niece, whereupon stopping for hot dogs, Ash told Sarah that she was probably the fattest person ever in the history of human beings. Fat jokes seemed to be among his favorite, despite Sarah weighing maybe 100 pounds soaking wet. While Sarah and Ash spent their days searching for a vehicle, Aaron and I set out to find suitable clothes. My jacket was laughably insufficient. Not only that, but even Aaron's super badass Navajo squall jean jacket wasn't going to cut it. I needed a hoodie and some pants, and we both needed thermal undergarments of some kind. So we set out using the bus system to find some clothes in downtown Perth. The transportation turned out to be easily navigable, and we found our way around the city without any issues. We made our way to a mall we'd located on the internet before leaving Anna's, and located a Kathmandu store, the equivalent to the North Face or REI in the United States. Read, expensive. It was the only store we could find that sold lightweight thermals to wear under our clothes. Aaron located a clearance rack with thermals, but they were all, and I know you're about to think I'm fucking with you, patterned just like the purple and pink blanket patches on his Navajo jean jacket. I laughed and told him I was paying the extra $2 or $3 for black ones. "No one's ever going to see them. Who cares?" Aaron asked in frustration at my insistence on spending the extra money. "Well, honestly, I'll probably wear these hunting and hiking back home, so I'm going to get something that I like," I argued. "Whatever. I'm not spending the extra money when I can get these ones that work perfectly fine." "Well, you do you, buddy." So I went with the black set, and Aaron went with the 80s aerobic wear collar explosion set. I bought a cheapo hoodie that said "I Heart Perth" on it, Anna laughed in my face for that later, from a touristy shop, and a pair of jeans and a t-shirt from a Kmart located in the mall. We were unable to find any sleeping bags for a cheap enough price in the mall. Everything in Kathmandu was outrageous, so we opted to search later for one at another outdoor store. On the way back to the bus station, I spotted a stage being set up and several food vendors lined up along a community center of sorts. Intrigued, I walked up and asked one of the food vendors what was going on. "It's a festival we have every month where local bands play. Should stick around and check it out," he told me. "What do you think, Aaron?" I asked. "I'd like to check out some local music." "I'd rather just head back to the house." "Really? And do what? Sit on Facebook? We're in Australia. Let's enjoy it, man." "I'm just not really into that kind of thing like you are. Kind of just want to head back and relax." I was mind-boggled. Even knowing how Aaron was, it still surprised me that he would rather sit on his computer in a dark room than watch a local band play. Looking back, I'd say it had something to do with Luk Tao, the Thai girl who he'd still been chatting with almost every day. He wanted to get back and talk to her, probably. "Well, I'm staying, so you can do whatever you want, dude." He was a little surprised at that. Oh, I mean, well, that's cool, I guess. So you want me to just ride back on the bus alone then? Yeah, if that's okay. I was a little confused at his hesitance, given the bus system had been pretty simple. Well, do you think you can walk with me to the bus station? What? I'm just not sure I can find it. Could you walk me there? Dude, I can give you a map and write on it where to go. It's like 5 blocks. I really don't want to walk all the way there and then all the way back. He stared at me with desperation. Oh, for fuck's sake. Fine. I later commented that it had started to seem like I was his dad and he was my mom at the same time. What I mean by that is, he was always nagging like a mother would. I think you should probably go to bed soon if we're going to be waking up early tomorrow, etc. But at the same time, I'd had to hold his hand through practically everything he did for the entire duration of the trip. I mean, he couldn't even walk to the bus station by himself? It was driving me crazy. I barely said a word the whole way. I could tell he was probably expecting me to walk all the way there and then decide not to walk the distance back to the festival, thus cajoling me into heading back to Anna's with him. Who knows, maybe that was the real reason he begged me so pathetically to take him to the bus station like a child. When we arrived across the street from the bus station, I blatantly patronized him by asking in a very sarcastic and motherly tone, "Okay, Aaron, that's the bus station across the street there. Do you need me to cross the walk with you, or do you think you can do that by yourself?" He didn't catch, or at least didn't acknowledge, my patronizing attitude. "No, that's okay. Do you need me to help you get to your bus? It's bus number 26. You'll have to look on the platform listings to see where it will be at." "No, I should be able to handle it." "All right, well, I'm going back to the park to hear some music." "You're not buying food or anything down there, though, right?" he asked in his usual thinly veiled condescending tone. "No, man, I'm just going to go watch some bands play." "All right, just making sure." I gave him the map with the bus schedules on it to lie to rest all worries of him accidentally boarding a bus to Darwin or something. Then I watched as he made his way across the crosswalk, stopped on the sidewalk on the other side to look confusedly in both directions for a moment, and then made his way to the bus station. "Jesus Christ," I muttered to myself in frustration, before turning around and walking to the first fast food joint I saw and stuffing my face with greasy goodness just to spite him. I almost bought a beer at the festival, but decided that starving to death later in the trip wouldn't be worth the proverbial middle finger to Aaron now. Instead, I just enjoyed the music and later opted for the longer bus route home to see part of the city and have some alone time while I listened to my iPod. Sometime the next day, we went with Ashley and Sarah to look at the vehicle they were buying. While they met up with the vehicle seller to check it out, Aaron and I wandered off to a mall nearby where we had a lapse of willpower. I can't remember the conversation that led to it, but we somehow convinced ourselves that we should buy a pack of cigarettes. Just one more pack, and then we'd be done. Isn't that how it always goes? Anyway, we entered the first tobacco store we could find and bought a pack of, quote, cheap cigarettes. Afterwards, we sat on a bench and each lit one up. This is a lot like banging an ugly chick from the bar or something, I commented. "You're really desperate, and it sounds like a great idea in the moment, but as soon as you do it, you just feel bad." Aaron laughed. "Yeah, it's like a switch gets flipped, and you feel guilty or something all of a sudden." "Exactly. Kind of like jacking off." "Huh? You feel guilty when you masturbate?" "Well, yeah." "Dude, that Catholic school really fucked you up." "No, I mean, well, you know what the Bible says about spreading your seed upon the earth and stuff." "Did you just call your cum seed?" "Well, the Bible just says that your seed should only be used for procreation." I winced. "Aaron, I think I see your problem. If you keep calling your jizz seed, No girl is ever going to sleep with you. There was an uncomfortable laugh between us, and I once again pondered how I had ended up traveling with someone so vastly different than me. This certainly could explain why the kid had so much pent-up anger. Maybe he needed to take a few minutes and crank one out every once in a while. All I could do was laugh and feel bad for him. "Do you want to go on a road trip with us?" Ash asked us one day while we were eating dinner a couple nights later. "We're going to buy that Jeep tomorrow, and we're thinking about driving around for a while. You two are more than welcome to join if you're keen." I was already on board without even asking any questions, but I asked them anyway. "For how long?" "Just a couple of weeks. Didn't you say you had a friend that moved to the Outback?" "Yeah, Ryan. He's in Calgary." "Well, we're thinking we just drop you off with him and then head to the farm where we're working, and you guys just catch the train back to Perth." I was elated. Dude, that would be amazing. Aaron was on board as well, so I contacted Ryan, who was just as excited to hear the news as we were. I told him it would be a week or two until we made it there, which he said was fine. It seemed our experience in Oz might turn out well after all. The next day, we went with Ash and Sarah to pick up their new vehicle, a Mitsubishi Pajero. They're heavy-duty off-road vehicles similar to a Range Rover or FJ Cruiser in the U.S. We stopped off at an outdoor store we spotted along the way, where I searched for a sleeping bag and Aaron searched for a liner. The cheapest one I could find was $60 USD, but there was little choice. We would be camping the entire time during the road trip with Ash and Sarah, so I would freeze if I didn't have one. This, of course, prompted more bickering between Aaron and me. "You're going to spend $60 on a sleeping bag." "I don't really have a choice, man," I said. "You spent all that money on that stupid jacket in Kuala Lumpur, and it's pretty much worthless, so we had to buy even more clothes when we got here. Aaron, listen, you're right. I fucked up with the jacket." I was genuinely embarrassed that I'd wasted money on that worthless piece of clothing. "But what the fuck can I do about it now?" "Well, I'm just saying, you're going to blow through all our money before we even get..." "Aaron, what do you want me to do to fix it? What can I do now that will make it right?" "I guess there's nothing you can do now, but then why the fuck are you yelling at me right now? It's pointless. I made a mistake, and I'm sorry for that, but lecturing me isn't going to change it. You know what? Just do whatever the hell you want. If you want to spend all our money on dumb shit, just go for it." I grabbed the sleeping bag and walked up to the counter where I paid for it, walked back outside, and smoked one of the last remaining cigarettes. Ash and Sarah had witnessed our angry exchange and had slipped quietly off to another part of the store where they focused on buying supplies for our road trip. I scribbled in my journal the usual rants and ravings about my travel partner, and tried to calm myself down before walking back into the store to help Sarah and Ash with their stuff. My mood was lightened a bit watching Ash hilariously petition Sarah for permission to buy a $190 spear gun. The thing was massive. It looked like the type of weapon you'd take down a prize marlin with. He claimed it would pay for itself when he killed all of our food with it. "Ashley, you're not spending 200 quid on a fucking spear gun." "But it would be fucking epic. Imagine all the animals I could kill with this thing. Dolphins, kangaroos, snakes. You aren't going to kill any animals, you dolt. You wouldn't even know how to operate that contraption. How about I fucking buy it anyways and just shoot you? And then we'll see just how much your opinion fucking matters, Sarah. If I wasn't around to keep you from doing stupid shit like this on a daily basis, you'd be dead within a week yourself." Ashley lost the battle in the end, but vowed to return and buy the spear gun at some point. He brought it up every day for a week afterwards. "See, if you would have let me buy my spear gun..." Aaron and I didn't speak to each other during the whole ride home. On top of our argument in the store, every single thing he was doing was starting to piss me off. He nagged incessantly, asking stupid questions every 5 minutes, figuratively insisting I hold his hand during everything he did, and obsessing and watching over my every move. Everything one of us said, it seemed like the other would try to prove it wrong or otherwise disagree. It was never ending. We had gotten along so well in Asia, and now here we were only a week into Oz and already back at square one. I was nearing my breaking point and didn't know what was going to happen when I finally reached it. Just one more month, I thought to myself. There were only 5 weeks or so remaining until our return flight to the United States. Once arriving in Los Angeles, I'd be staying with an aunt for about a month, and Aaron would be flying to his grandparents' house in Phoenix. The journey back to Ohio from California hadn't been figured out in the least bit, and it was something that would be difficult to organize. By the time we hit U.S. soil, we knew we'd be broke. We thought about hitchhiking back or possibly trying to scrounge enough money to get a bus ticket. All I knew was that once we made it to California, I was going to be away from Aaron. I didn't care about the rest just yet. I was getting so sick of the friction between us. Even when we'd gotten along so well in Asia, his mannerisms had still irked me. I'd just done a better job at keeping quiet about them. I'm sure he was at the same point with me. I don't care if you like someone or not. If you spend every single waking moment together for months on end, you're gonna want some time apart. Now imagine that you don't get along with that person. That's taking it lightly. Imagine that you have grown to almost hate that person. Now imagine that everything you do is decided by them in some fashion because you share all of your money, of which there's very little. You can't even go and buy a pack of gum without consulting them first. You can't buy a goddamn apple without asking their permission. Don't misunderstand me. I know it wasn't all Aaron. I know I'm hard to get along with sometimes. I've said that right from the beginning of this book. I have a bad habit of taking jokes too far sometimes, made far worse if you don't understand my humor, and Aaron certainly fell into that category. I'm sure I did all kinds of shit that annoyed him to no end. And to his credit, he did a better job handling it than me while we were in Australia. I knew all of that at the time even, but I was still angry, annoyed, and ready to be done with the arguments and eggshell walking. As I browsed the outdoor store with Ash and Sarah, I noticed a display of lightweight foldable shovels and found myself wondering, I wonder how long it would take to dig a grave in the outback with one of those things. There was a moment where I glanced back at Aaron and our eyes met. I think he knew what I was thinking. He was probably wondering the same thing. End of chapter 26. Chapter 27. Road Trip. Perth, Australia to Albany, Australia. When I was young, I used to have this thing where I wanted to see everything. I used to think, how can I die without seeing every inch of this world? Leonardo DiCaprio. October 21st. Upon leaving Perth to take a walkabout, or more appropriately, driveabout through Western Australia, we had two goals. One, see a kangaroo. Two, don't run out of money. It didn't take too long to achieve the first goal. Shortly after leaving Perth, Ash shouted to Sarah as we were driving down the highway. Babe, get your camera! I see a kangaroo! Sarah excitedly rummaged to the middle console to pull out her camera. Where is it? Where is it? I don't see it. Right there! He pointed with a huge smile to a dead and decomposing pile of fur right next to the road. Our first kangaroo was roadkill. She shot him an angry stare as she set the camera back down with an annoyed sigh. He just kept smiling. Should I turn around so you can get a photo? You're such a dick, Ashley. It seemed to take a decade to really get moving south from Perth. We stopped a short drive away and camped, planning to do some work on the Jeep the following day. Ash wanted to put a bed of sorts in the back, which would consist of a plywood platform which he would span across the back hatch at the same height as the back seats when they were folded forward. This would give them not only a shelf in the back, allowing more gear to be stowed, but also a sleeping area when the seats were folded forward. They were planning to use this after dropping us off in Kalgoorlie with Ryan. When we made it to the hardware store the next day, the employees agreed to give us use of some power tools and an area in the lumberyard to work on the Jeep's modifications.